Okay, we'll get started. So first things, just a few minutes ago, I posted assignment one. You'll have 2 weeks to do assignment one. You can see it on the course website now. There's two questions. One of them's about hashes, sort of doing the types of calculations we did in class where you have an expected value. And then the other one is asking about max, which and PRGs, which you'll see. So we'll see PRGs today. We might see enough of max for you to be able to do it. It may be the case that A and B, you have to wait till after next week's class in order to do it. Do we have a next week's class?
No.
Okay. So anyways, we'll see where we're at the end of this class, and I can drop those questions if we if I don't feel that you can answer them at the end of that class. So that's assignment one. You can do it by yourself. Don't copy from others. If you copy from others, you'll end up with a worse mark than if you just handed in nothing. There's also a slip day. So for a slip day, what that means is that you can hand in one of the two assignments late. Okay, your choice. So you can do it for assignment one, or you can do it for assignment two. You don't have to ask my permission or anything like that. You just hand it in late. So late means Wednesday by 4 p.m. as opposed to Monday. End of class. So it gives you almost 2 days. The reason it's four is because you'll have to leave in my mailbox because I probably won't be in my office. And the mailbox room closes, like it's actually locked. I think it might close at 4:30, but anyways, you won't be able to get in to that room itself. Okay? So you can either slip on assignment one. If you don't slip on assignment one and get it in on time, then you'll have a few extra days for assignment two. But if something comes up and you're too busy to do assignment one by the due date, then you can slip here, but then you'll have to be a little more careful with assignment two and make sure you get assignment two in on time. Any questions about that? It can be handwritten, it can be typed, preferred type, but you can handwrite it if you want. Answers don't have to be long. We're not looking for essays. Okay, any questions about it? Okay. The schedule is kind of weird. Ideally, this would have come out last week. It would have worked a little bit better. Because next week is a holiday, maybe next week I'll set up a special office hour because I'm sure people have questions. But you can email me your questions because there won't be a class in between when it's today and when it's due. Also, the midterm is going to be the week after it's due. So if you slip with this, then I can't even post the solution. So think of the assignment as completely separate from the midterm. So you're not going to see the solution to the assignment or get your assignments back before you write the midterm. But the questions are going to be very different. Assignment questions you're meant to think about for a couple days. Exam questions you have to answer on the spot. Okay, so hopefully, not seeing the assignment questions won't impede your ability to do the midterm. If you want to see some sample questions, a better thing to do would be look at last year's course website. You'll see last year's midterm with solutions, and you'll also see last year's assignments. And if you keep going back through history, you can see lots of midterms and lots of assignments if you want sample questions. Okay, questions about this? Okay, before we start, any questions from last class? Okay. Yeah, sure. So length extension attack, I won't redraw it out, but let's just pull up the notes from last class. So this diagram is probably the best illustration of it. So the attack basically says, if I give you y, do you know what x is in this diagram? The answer is no. Why don't you know what x is? Because of pre-image resistance. Okay? So you don't know anything about x. Now, it might follow, you might think, well, if I don't know anything about x, there's no way I could potentially modify x, right? Even if it was like in such a way that I don't know what it is. Like I could take x and add something to the end of it without actually knowing what x is. Turns out hash functions don't have that property, at least not the ones that follow Merkle-Damgård like this. So if you have the output of the hash, so this y value here and this y value are exactly the same, you can pick up the Merkle-Damgård and you can add on new blocks, run them through the compression function, and you'll get the hash of y prime, which is x concatenated with a, you have no idea, you still don't know what x is, right? So why is this useful? Well, let's say there's an attack where like you see h of x go across the wire, and it's like locking in a value. So they're going to tell you what x is later, but they just want to lock it in for whatever reason, okay? Or they want to send a short value. So what you can do is you can replace it, if you're an adversary on the wire, you can replace it with your a added onto the end, okay? Now, in the future, sometime, the actual value of x will go across the wire. Now you do know what it is, so you can grab it, you can stick your a on the end and send that along. And so now it looked like the person had sent the hash of xa all along when really they meant to send hash of x itself, okay? So we'll see that exact attack. So what I described is sort of a very cheap version of doing what's called a MAC. And so we'll see why the length extension attack doesn't work in the context of MACs. Or rather, hash functions that are susceptible to length extension do not work in the context of MACs if you do them in a sort of naive way. Yep. So then what do you do to... So the fundamental reason it works is because the internal state on this wire right here, it represents all of this computation. You don't have to know any previous value. Basically, it all gets distilled down to this value in the wire, right? So if you want to keep going, you just need this output value, okay? Now, if that value is exactly the same as the value you publish as the output of your hash, then not only are you publishing a hash, but you're also publishing sort of the internal state, right? So the trick is, when you publish that value, don't publish your entire internal state. Okay, so if you need your hash output to be 256, then what you need to do is you need to have this internal state be bigger than 256 somehow. So you could just blow all the values up, so they're all 512 values now, and then you just, when you, your output of your hash is like the last half of it, or the first half. Or you could completely change the structure from this sort of chain-based structure. So those are sort of the two types of approaches that you might do. Yes.
You had mentioned about the extractors that they don't exactly give out the same value they take. That is, they give half.
Yes.
Why is it so? Is it because of its internal structure?
Yeah. Okay. So we have a bit string, and there's two things that we're concerned about with a bit string. Okay. One is, how long is it? Okay. So maybe it's 256 big bits long. Maybe it's a gig. Okay. The other thing is, how much randomness is in it in terms of bits, okay? Now, the amount of randomness in a string will never be greater than the string itself. So a 128-bit string can at most have 128 bits of randomness, right? That's the upper bound. That means every bit is equally random. But it could have a lot less, right? So imagine if you, say it was a bunch of stock prices, okay? So stocks are kind of random, right? We have this feeling that stocks are random, but they're not completely random, right? It's not like if Google's trading at, whatever, $600, it's not going to go to $100,000, right? But that cent, right, that last value, whether it closes on 1 cent, 2 cent, 3 cent, that's very random, right? So that's an example of a number where there's some randomness in it, but it's not uniformly random. Okay, so what's an extractor? So an extractor is something where you take as input a long number that's not fully random, right? It's sort of partially random. There's random bits, and you don't know where the bits are, okay? You could put your thinking hat on. If you knew what the data was, you could say, well, that bit is more random than this bit, and like sort of pick out the random bits. But if you just want to do it in a generic way, where you're like, okay, I have this long string, there's randomness in there somewhere. I don't know exactly where it is. I don't care. I just want to put it through a general function that will spit out a much shorter string that's fully random. You can do that, okay? So that's an extractor, but you have to be careful. And extractors, because they're not going in hand-picking out the randomness, they're just sort of picking it from everywhere, you're going to have to be a little more conservative in terms of how you use them. And so the conservative bound for an extractor is that you need twice as much randomness in the input than the output, because it's not a perfectly efficient process. You're going to lose about half of the randomness just because it's a general process.
So this thing is like about the internal structure of the extractor, that it requires 2D of the data.
Exactly. Yeah. Because it's a general function. In fact, it's not even the internal structure. I mean, you can read the theory papers about it, but any deterministic function is going to have a bound something like that. But yeah, anyways. Okay, so that's an extractor. So where do we use extractors? Well, it's actually a good place to start. So before we do that, I'll field any other questions you have for my section. Okay. Right, so we left off with this idea that your computer is going to use an extractor, which it does. And it's going to use it in combination with another primitive called a pseudo-random generator. So I'm going to define a PRG, and then we'll circle back to how your computer actually works. Okay? And I'll show you, I'll actually show it to you. Okay, so a PRG is very similar to a hash function or an extractor in the sense that we haven't seen keys yet. So this is a function that just takes an input and gives you an output. Okay, the difference between an extractor and a hash function and a PRG has to do with the sizes of inputs and outputs. Okay, this is like the exact opposite of a hash function in a certain sense, where the input, which we call the input, or we sometimes call it the seed, it's going to be fixed size, okay? For a PRG, that's right, yeah. Okay, so it's going to be, we'll call it k bits long, and just to give you a hint, where we're going with is k is greater than 112, okay, or exactly 112 for the normal attack. And the output, in this case, is going to be infinite, okay, as long as you want. And the output we call the output, or sometimes we call it a key stream because it's used in a specific context that we'll see later. Okay? So what is a PRG just sort of tangentially? Like what does it actually do? So what a PRG is meant to do is it's meant to expand randomness for you. So let's say you want to generate a bunch of random numbers. I don't know, you need a bunch of keys, or let's say you have a password manager. Okay, you have your password manager, and it's going to generate a bunch of random passwords, and every time you get a new account, you're going to generate a new random password, okay? And let's say it's actually for, like, a corporation, not just for one individual, so there's, like, I don't know, hundreds, thousands of these passwords being generated, okay? Now, what you could do is you could go try and harvest true randomness from somewhere in order to generate these passwords, okay? An alternative is you could use a PRG. So with a PRG, you'll start with a truly random seed, okay? So your seed value will be like 128 bits. So you can flip a coin 128 bits or 128 times or whatever a computer does, that's the equivalent. And now you have this truly random seed. And then what you can do is you can run it through this algorithm and it will output a much longer sequence as long as you want of something that looks random. It's so close to random, it's close enough to random that it might as well be random, okay? What does that mean, it's so close to random that it might as well be random? It means that a computer would not be able to distinguish the output of this function from an actually truly random output, okay? They are distinguishable in theory, okay? Mainly because, let's say we generate 4 gigs of data, right? Here, there's only 2 to the k versions of that 4 gig of data, okay? That's not every possible version of 4 gigs of data, okay? So this will be, it will only output a subset. So if you had infinite computational power, you could think of it this way, you could brute force every seed. Every seed would give you a completely different output. But at the end of the day, when you're done, if you see an output that's different than all the outputs when you tried every seed, then you would conclude that it was truly random. That it wasn't the output of this function, okay? So they are distinguishable in theory, but in order to do that attack, you'd have to try every seed. How long would it take you to try every seed? Well, if it's 112 bits and it's truly random, then it's going to take you 2 to the 112th. NIST says that's impossible. That's the parameter that we're going to. Therefore, you won't be able to do, you won't be able to test every seed that's possible. Okay, so that's why we say it's computationally. Now, we also have to worry about whether there's some sort of internal defects so that you could distinguish it without trying every seed. Okay, so when we write our security definition, what does it mean for this to be secure? We want to take in consideration these things. Okay, so if I hand you two sequences of bits, both of them are the same length. One of them I actually flipped coins to generate, and the other one I flipped 128 coins or 112 coins to get me the C, and then I ran it through this function. You won't be able to tell the difference, okay, in a reasonable amount of time. So once again, this is it's infeasible is the key word. So not impossible, just infeasible. Okay, now another thing I didn't note that I probably should note is this is a deterministic function. Okay, and as I mentioned, every function we see in this course will be deterministic. Okay, when it's non-deterministic, we'll account for the randomness as an input to the function, not in terms of the internals of the function itself. So what does that mean? It means if you start with the same C value, you'll get the same output. Okay, so if you try X today and I try the same X tomorrow and we're on completely different computers, we're going to get the same output sequence of bits. Okay, so it's fully deterministic. Okay, so we're not cheating, we're not introducing any randomness in terms of the function itself. Okay, now if we're saying that you can't tell the difference between this and a truly random bit string, okay, a sort of lemma of that statement is there should be no way to recover X from Y either, okay? If we can look at Y and we can recover X, then once we know X, we can run it through the PRG and confirm that, yeah, it's generating Y. Then we know that this isn't a truly random bit string, okay? So a PRG has the same property as a hash function. It has pre-image resistance. As well. We don't usually call it pre-image resistance in the context of a PRG, but it should be, if this property is going to hold, a consequence of it is there's no way to tell the X given Y. Okay? So how do we use this in real life? The idea is that X is going to be a secret, okay? It's going to be our seed, we know that value, and Y is going to be public, okay? We're going to hand these Y values out to other people. We're going to say, here's the key that I want to use or whatever the case may be, okay? So people are going to see Ys from your PRG, and they shouldn't know that you sort of cheated and you used the PRG as opposed to actually generating it truly from random, okay? And it's going to, and one way to ensure that, or one thing that has to hold in order for that to be true is you can't recover the seed from the output. Otherwise, that'd be a very easy way of attacking it, okay? The second thing is, if you can't distinguish it from truly random, then it has all the properties of a truly random string, okay? And the one that's important is a PRG, the way you use it is a little different than most crypto functions. So most crypto functions, you at some point in time, you have your input, you put it through the function, and you take your output. You're taking all of your output, and you're using it to do some protocol, okay? A PRG, you use it more like on demand, okay? So you have this seed, and you'll come along and you'll be like, give me the first, you know, I need 128 bits of randomness, so give that to me, okay? And then you go and you use it for your crypto protocol. Then later, like an hour later, you're like, okay, I need another key. So you'll go back to this and you'll say, okay, and it will remember sort of how much it's given to you and it will give you the next chunk, okay? So this is kind of like, it's kind of like a state that's sitting there and you're coming along and you're grabbing the output, okay? It's not that you actually output a huge string and then you start grabbing it. Yeah?
Why didn't it just generate a new random output every time? Why did it keep the same numbers?
So it does give you a new random output. Like the bits will be new bits, but I don't know exactly what you're asking. Are you asking why doesn't it reseed itself with the output?
No, I mean, why doesn't it take a new X every time you ask?
Yeah. So the answer is that X is expensive. So your computer has trouble coming up with X values. If your computer had no problem generating X values, then you would just use X values. You wouldn't need this particular function, okay? But it turns out that generating X values is expensive, and you never really know like how much randomness is there or not. So what your computer will do is it will generate a conservative amount where it knows it's more than double this amount, like way more, and then it will just do it once, and then that's why it's going to use this function. Yeah, it's also quicker, just in terms of, so I'm sort of like phrasing it as you need 128 bits every hour or something like that. That's not the case at all, right? You go to a website, your computer is going to start generating randomness to generate the keys that are necessary and different values to connect to that website. And if I go to google.com, I have like one connection to google.com, but then like the images are on like some other server. So I have another one to images.google.com. And then there's like cookies that are tracking me around the internet, you know, going to like ads.google.com. And, you know, so when you go to google.com, you're actually going to like 200 sites. You're getting content and you're kind of weaving it together. So, and that all happens in like a fraction of a second, or maybe it might take a full second. So, you know, you're doing like 200 like crypto connections in the course of 1 second. So you do need these numbers very fast. So you're using them quite quickly. Yeah. The other thing I should say is this is the security definition for a cryptographically secure PRG. You can, if you're like, let's say you're doing like statistical analysis, like you're simulating some like future stock values or something like that, and you want really fast randomness for your simulations, in that case, you don't need it to be secure. So there are faster ways that are still statistically close to a uniform random output. But if you look at the output, you could reverse engineer what the actual input was, okay? So you can use those for like fast simulations and things like that. So things based on linear feedback shift registers, cellular automata, that kind of stuff you can use. But in this course, we're concentrating on secure PRGs. So a secure one means that when you look at that output, you can't figure out that it came out of a PRG as opposed to actually being truly random. Not just that it's statistically close, but it's that it's computationally infeasible to even determine that fact. Other questions?
PRGs that close to actual randomized output, then why we use the actual randomized output? We use PRG all the way.
Use like a true RG, you mean? Or
there are some cases where we use PRGs, and there are some cases where we actually like generate random.
Right.
So we can like just use PRGs there as well.
Exactly. So for the PRG, you do need a small truly random seed. right? So the only case, literally the only case that you need a true random number generator is for that seed. Once you have that seed, yes, you can use that all the way. There is no point ever, using true random numbers. Other questions? Yeah.
Just on your example with Google.com, so you mentioned you have maybe 200 crypto connections. Is it you have 200x that are compute, and you have 200 different y, and those y
no.
are you?
So what you'll do is you'll have 1x, and you'll do this, like when your computer boots up, you'll get this x value. And then what you'll do is you'll take the first chunk of y and use it. Then you'll take the next chunk of y, the next chunk of y. Yeah. So that's what I'm going for, is that you're sort of, you're generating this y on demand as you need it. Okay. So it's sort of like continually generating more and more bits. And so you can grab it. Yeah. And you don't have to ever stop. You can keep going. So technically we say it's infinite forever. It will loop. It has to loop because this is finite. So there is only a finite number of outputs before it will cycle back at some point. But that's going to happen like after the lifetime of the universe when you hit that cycle, hopefully.
That's where the point that it is similar to the random output.
Yeah, so that's another way. That's another way you could distinguish it from a truly random. So a truly random will never loop. This will eventually cycle. And so once you see that cycle, then you could say, okay, I know this is a PRG. But that's the cycle length should be so long that you'll never go around it. Yeah. That's a technical point that doesn't really matter. It has to be truly random to get these properties. Yeah. 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 Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So I'll show you that in a second. Yeah. Okay. Let me write the other lemma. So the idea, I got sort of sidetracked with this idea that you're withdrawing bits, you know, bits at a time or bytes at a time. So the other lemma is that if you've seen some of the output, there should be no way to predict the next set of output. So if I wrote down the first 100 bytes that this thing has generated out, I have no idea what the next byte is better than a random guess. Okay, that's another consequence of it. So I'll say it a little more strictly in terms of bits. So it's infeasible to predict the next bit. In Y, given, we'll say the rest of the, or I'll say the preceding bits of Y. All the preceding bits. And that's true, like you can study a million bits of this output and there's no way you're gonna guess that next bit with better than 50-50 probability until you actually compute it. So let me note but not X. If you know X, then it's trivial, right? Because you can compute what the next bit is. Okay, I'll give you some examples, and then I'll circle back to the extractor PRG combination. So some statistical PRGs that you'll see. I'm mainly saying this so that you, when you see them, you know not to use them for crypto applications. Linear feedback shift registers. There's something called a Mercantine twister. That's popular. So these are just names. You don't have to know how they work. LFSRs were used as secure crypto PRGs, but then they were broken. So like early like cell phone protocols and things like that use these, but they're too simple, so you can break them by doing some actually algebra on them. And then for crypto ones, so what happens is that you can use a PRG directly. So I forget the one that your computer uses. I should have it for the notes. And The more common place that you see it is we're going to use this as a building block for encryption. Okay, so there's a certain type of encryption. It's called stream ciphers. We haven't seen them yet. But the most common implementation of a PRG is inside a stream cipher. So every stream cipher will first define a PRG, and then they'll define the stream. The stream cipher is always the same, the way that you combine the PRG with the key. So they just go by the name of the stream cipher itself. So A5, 1, and 2 are insecure. These were used in cell phones. They were based on linear feedback shift registers. There's probably an A53 at this point. I don't really follow that space. Probably the widely deployed one is called RC4. It was used in SSL for a long time. In fact, you can still see it. It was used in WEP. WEP is the wireless protocol. There was some problems with how it was used in WEP. It wasn't actually RC4 itself that was broken. It was the way it was implemented in WEP that was broken. But that was a high-profile case. So we went hunting for RC4 replacement. The one that people seem to be coalescing around is called Cha-Cha-20. So this is a secure stream cipher that you can use that has a PRG, and I'll show it to you when we get to stream ciphers, which will be either later this class or next class. Okay, the other way you can do is you can look inside an encryption function to find a stream cipher if it's a stream cipher. Sorry, you can find a PRG inside a stream cipher encryption function, or if you have an encryption function that's not based on a stream cipher, you can use it as well to generate PRGs. So the sort of complement to a stream cipher, a way of doing encryption that's basically equivalent to a stream cipher, it just has different efficiency properties, is to use something called a block cipher. And if you run a block cipher in what's called counter mode, that is a PRG. Okay, none of those words mean anything to you at this point. That's fine. Later, when you see block ciphers in counter mode, we'll make that point again that this is just a PRG, and then you can circle back to this part of the text to see that we sort of predicted it coming. Okay, so we'll see Cha-Cha-20, and I'll show you counter mode with something called AES, which is a block cipher. And so you'll see, let's put EG AES CTR. So you'll see two PRGs, but you're going to have to wait a couple lectures to actually see them. Okay, I'll give you two use cases. The second use case is going to be encryption itself. So use case one is encryption, which we'll see shortly. And the other one is the one that I hinted at. Okay, the second is the way computers generate randomness. So what we do in a computer is we sort of harvest, you can think of it as semi-random. Data. And it can come from different like components, or there's different, like, even though a computer is strictly deterministic, right, it follows certain steps, there can be like kind of non-deterministic things, like if you have multi-threading, exactly when does a context switch over, especially in terms of real time, like how many seconds will it will a context switch to another app and then switch back, okay? But also when you have a user sitting at a computer, then there's lots of randomness, right? Even as I'm like sort of writing this out, that the way I write it, if you trace the exact pixels that this little pen goes over, there is some randomness there, right? I'm not going to write it exactly the same time. When you type, right, you do have a sort of pattern to how you type, but exactly the number of milliseconds between each keystroke, that is going to vary somewhat, okay? So there is some randomness there, okay? So there's a lot of sources of kind of randomness. So what we do is we just put a rough estimate of how much, you know, so we might say 100 keystrokes would give you, you know, 12 bits of randomness, right? And some like completely like back of the envelope sort of rough guess, okay? But if we do enough of this, what we can do is we can build a big pool of semi-random data. And what we need is we just need something that's bigger than the seed, well, bigger than double the seed of a PRG, okay? And that's only 256 bits. That's not a lot of randomness. It's not that hard. It's not that hard to probably get that much randomness, okay? So what your computer will do is it will kind of keep track of it, and eventually it will say, okay, I think I have enough. And then what it will do is it will generate a seed for the PRG, but it can't use this data directly because it's sort of semi-random, right? So if I like move my mouse from here to here, you kind of know roughly where it's going, but you don't know the exact pixels that I'm going to go through, okay? So you sort of have a rough sense, so it's not completely random. It's not like it's jumping all around, but at the same time, it's not perfectly predictable either, okay? So you have this kind of data that's there's some randomness in there, but it's hard to get out. So how do we get it out? We use an extractor. And then once we have our seed, then we can use a PRG, and then now we can generate randomness, and we can generate it as quickly as we can run the PRG function itself, which is very, very fast, okay? They're very, very fast functions, okay? So we don't have to wait for a user to come along and wiggle their mouse or whatever the case may be. Now, if you've ever done things like, I don't know, the only application that comes to mind is like if you, like if you do PGP, which is like email encryption, when you're setting up your keys, it will be like, okay, wiggle your mouse around. Okay, and you'll see this like user interface and you kind of like wiggle your mouse around and then your key like kind of gets longer and longer, the amount of entropy, and then it's like, boom, okay, now we'll generate a key for you. So sometimes it exposes, some applications will expose this sort of to the user in terms of the interface, but generally this just happens in the background without you knowing it, okay? Now, if you want to get randomness, where do you get it from? So generally, if you're coding, you're going to call some function that's just going to output it. But if you want it, it's also sitting just at a file directory. So on Unix, for example, you can go to dev/random. That's not going to work. Okay, so this is my computer's PRG spinning at random bits. So you can just go there, grab random bits. But normally you don't go at the operating system level and do it. You're going to use some function in whatever language that you're doing. And it's going to do this grabbing for you. But if you ever want to see it, that's sort of what it looks like. It's all like special characters because they end up being weird. But this is it in hex. Okay. So you can see how quickly a computer can generate random numbers. And then if you're on Windows, there's an equivalent kind of place that you can do it. I'll just write what I did. Or actually, let me... I can't do it quick enough. It's going to screenshot it in. Okay. Sorry, dev/random. And so your computer actually has two sources of randomness. One is the secure version and one's the insecure version. So the other one's called urandom. So this is on Unix. Sorry. Okay. So let me get this right. Okay, so dev/random, what it actually does is it gives you the seed values here, okay? So dev/random will give you these seed values, okay? So it's not actually the output of the PRG, okay? But because it has to wait for human interaction or whatever the case may be, inter-process things, sometimes it will halt, okay? Meaning that if you go and ask it for randomness, it might not have it at its fingertips. It might be like, oh, I have to harvest more entropy before I give you that random value, okay? So you can use dev/random. In that case, you'll get basically access to the output of extractor bitstream. But it might halt. And if you go to dev/urandom, then it will give you the actual output of the PRG. And because it's deterministically generated, it will never halt. Okay, so you'll always have randomness there. I can always just generate it for you by running PRG. Okay, so that's a trade-off. So you can do whatever you want. So if you want to grab the sort of true randomness, the truer randomness, you can do that, but it might not be there if you need it. Okay, so if you have an application that's time critical, you know, some sort of real-time system or something like that, and you know, if you have to wait 2 seconds in order to get that randomness, that's too much, then you won't want to use functions that call dev/random. You would use dev/urandom. Yeah, so mainly for generating keys. So we haven't talked about what keys are, but keys are going to be critical to all encryption going forward from now on. So we'll look at encryption, max, public key encryption, signatures. All of them need keys. Keys come from this. You also see inside encryption functions, sometimes you need random numbers. So if you want something that's non-deterministic, you're going to use random numbers. Yeah, so we just haven't seen those applications yet. Other questions? So pseudo-random, so I'm not going to test you on this like very deeply because it's they're sort of tricky concepts. So you can think of randomness as being sort of at three levels. There's true randomness, I generated it with a coin, okay? Then there's things that are close to randomness that technically aren't truly random, but they're close by some distance, okay? And there's two ways to measure the distance between something that's close to random. One is to think in terms of statistics. So you could say statistically it looks random, okay? So that's what an extractor gives you. Technically, this output isn't truly random, it's statistically close to random. The other is to say a computer can't tell them apart, so it's indistinguishable. So that's what a PRG gives you. It gives you something that's indistinguishable from randomness, okay? Statistically is usually stronger than computational. So like true randomness is the strongest, statistical is the next strongest, and then computational is the next strongest. Now, I did mention these PRGs that are not cryptographically secure, and I said they're statistically close to randomness. So that's like kind of a fourth level that sounds the same as this, but when you actually look at the definition, this is a lot tighter. So yeah, anyway, the point is that like there's a lot of theory behind it. So I'm not going to cover it, but that gives you like sort of the rough outline. If you're super like interested in this, you could do a project on the different ways of talking about randomness and look at the definitions of each of them and sort out the differences between them. Yeah. Other questions? Okay, so before we go on, let me just do a quick review because we looked at three things that all look kind of the same. Hash functions, extractors, PRGs, they're all things that take one input, give you one output. So I just want to sort of put them all up together so you can see the differences a little more clearly. So hash extractor PRG. So all of them take some input X. All of them take some output Y. So hash and extractors, you're taking a big input generally, and you're mapping it down to a smaller size. So we can call this D, a fixed size. So an extractor, you know, it can go up to infinite. I'll write this. Yeah, exactly. And so a PRG is the opposite of these two, okay? So PRG is clearly in a different class than these two. Now, what's the difference between these two? Well, a hash input can be any size. So it could be bigger than D, smaller than D, exactly D. An extractor does have a floor on its size, okay? So an extractor, so the input, basically the size of X needs to be greater than 2D. Okay, usually it's much, much bigger than 2D. So that's one sort of restrictions. The output Y is statistically random. With PRG, Y is computationally random. Hash functions have, you know, PR and CR. And a PRG effectively has a PR kind of function. I'll call it one way just because we don't tend to use that term, even though it's exactly the same, okay? So you can't tell Y from X. Sorry, you can't tell X from given Y, okay? And then the question is, so hash and extractor look so similar. What if you only use the hash when your output met this kind of criteria? Would it always be statistically random? The answer is it's close enough that people do use hash functions as extractors. There's some work on the theory side that show that you shouldn't use a hash function. You should use a stronger primitive that's keyed, where the key is generated randomly, like a MAC or a block cipher in MAC mode. So we'll leave the theory aside. What I can tell you is that for years, TLS, which is the thing that connects to Google securely or whatever website you're visiting, it uses hash functions as extractors. And, you know, that there was never a problem, even though you couldn't prove that it was secure. There was never a known, like, practical attack on the fact that they use hash functions in that way. The new version, however, of TLS 1.3 doesn't do it that way. Or so I'm told. Okay. Questions about any of these three things? Yeah. So the extractor is not necessarily one way. So you might be able to determine the input, but it's because the input is bigger than the output. Let's just say that if you had an extractor where you could look at the output and say, I can write down some input that would give me that output, you didn't break the extractor. That's not a security property that we need. Yeah. So for example, that von Neumann extractor that I showed you with the flipping coins, once you have your output sequence, you could be like, okay, here's a bunch of flips that could have happened that would generate that output. Yeah. Yeah. So it's not really about keeping the input secret. Yeah.
And for the PRG, we defined the constant k that has to be greater than 112 bits for the PRG to be one way at the input. But can it take less?
No. Well, if it takes less, then you can brute force the key. Yeah, and so 112 is, now, in practice, you can't, once it's above 2 to the 70, you can't, in practice, brute force it. So you'd be safe, like, with a 100-bit seed, probably. But by NIST standards, they say we want to see resistance to any exhaustive search attack that's at least 112 bits.
So we follow the NIST standards.
So we fall in this standard. Yeah. And in practice, these things are usually 128, if not bigger, like 256. Yeah. So CHA-CHA-20s, I forget. I guess it... Yeah, I'm not sure. Okay, other questions? Yeah. So an extractor, yeah, it doesn't have either. Yeah, so it should be able to generate one or more inputs. So once again, if you think of that von Neumann extractor, you could write down 10 different sequences that would condense down to that particular thing. So those are all collisions. Yeah. So extractors aren't used the same way as a hash, but they're used to generate, basically you're taking this pool and you're reducing it down to a single value. And so if you can figure out a pool that would give you a particular value, there's no consequence there. There's no security consequence. Yeah. And if there's two different pools, once you have one pool that gives you a value, if you could change it and end up with the same value, that's fine too. Yeah.
That makes sense that there is no issue because they
have... Exactly. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And then since you run it through a PRG anyways, you get the one way from, like, you're basically doing y equals the PRG of the extraction of the bit stream. So you don't need both functions to have the property. As long as one has it, you can't go back. So it doesn't. So that's a natural question either. You don't need it. I mean, can you find... so in this case, it should actually be collision-free because the output is much bigger than the input. So I would expect that every unique value of an input would give you a completely different output, and that's totally possible because there's more outputs than inputs. So it's probably collision-free. So the way I'm giving you the hierarchy, yeah, we'll think of it that way. Yeah. And there's competing definitions of statistical randomness that would put it either above or below. But yeah. Other questions? Okay, so let's move on to encryption. So encryption is the main reason that everyone's here, right? Just kidding, you're here because it's required. Okay, so we're going to forget about all these for a bit, but as we'll see, they'll come back into play soon enough. Okay, so let's flush our memories of hash functions and extractors and randomness and entropy and all that stuff. And we'll go back to a basic scenario. So we have Alice... We have Bob. And they want to send a message to each other. They want to do it over the internet. The problem is there's lots of people sitting on the internet that are going to read their traffic. So we'll call these people Eve. Okay, Eve's bad. We don't want Eve to read our message. Okay, so Alice is going to send this message across. And by virtue of sending across, Eve can sit in the middle. And Eve can actually do two things, okay, that are bad. One thing is Eve might be able to read the message, okay, so maybe we don't want that. The other thing Eve might want to do is change the message, okay? So we're going to deal with these problems independently. So encryption is only about hiding the message, okay? And later we'll talk about message integrity, which is about stopping Eve from changing it, even if she can read it. And then we'll talk about composing both of them so that you can't do either, which is what we ultimately want. Okay, so how are we going to stop Eve from reading the message? Well, at the end of the day, if Bob and Eve know sort of the same stuff, right, then there's no way you can send a message that only Bob can read and Eve can't, okay? There has to be some difference between Eve and Bob. Okay, Bob has to know something that lets Bob read the message that Eve doesn't know. Okay, otherwise the whole thing doesn't work. Okay, so the idea of encryption originally, like in the war, was you would have a secret algorithm, and Alice would know it, and Bob would know it, and Eve wouldn't know it. But then it turned out that if you saw enough messages go back and forth, you could try and figure out what that algorithm was, and or if you stole a machine, that an actual encryption machine from the other, you know, the other country that you're fighting with, then you could reverse engineer it or whatever the case may be. Okay, so what we decided is a principle called Kirchhoff's principle, which says that all your secrets should be in the form of a key. So a key is like a number; it's random. It's big enough that you can't exhaustively search it, okay? So we can't use a password because you could try lots and lots of different passwords. So we're going to require it to be a little bigger, a little more random than a password. But we're going to call it a key. And what we're going to do is we're going to apply some function to this message using the key under the assumption that Bob knows the key, Alice knows the key. The values are the same. That's why it's called symmetric key. Later, we'll consider a scenario where the values aren't the same, okay? But for now, we'll just assume that they're the same value. And Eve does not know the key, okay, explicitly, okay? So Eve knows everything about the system. She knows the encryption algorithm that's used. She has an implementation of it, the decryption algorithm that's used, all of this stuff. She knows all of that information. The only thing she doesn't know is this one number, okay, this one key. And that should be enough to keep her from reading this message, okay? If it's enough, then we say this is a secure encryption scheme. So we want it to be infeasible to learn. And I'm going to be very strict. I'm going to say any information about M. So we might think, does she learn all of them? Well, even if she can decrypt one bit of them, we would say that encryption scheme is broken, okay? Even if she could learn a probability distribution over M that's something other than uniform, we would say that it's broken, okay? So we want to leak no information about M. In other words, after she sees this ciphertext, her guess at what M is no different than before she saw the ciphertext, okay? It doesn't give her any advantage in trying to guess what the value of this message is, okay? And we'll define this a little more formally than we've been doing all along, but we'll get there, okay? All right, so I'll give you sort of a roadmap of how we do it. So we're going to look at three ways of doing symmetric key encryption. Okay, the first one's called the one-time pad. The one-time pad is perfectly secure. Okay, it means like you can't break it even if you have infinite computational power. But there's something about it that makes it so impractical you would never use it in real life. Okay, so no one uses it, but we're just going to use it as a stepping stone to looking at stream ciphers. So stream ciphers are a practical version of a one-time pad. They're not perfectly secure, but they're secure against a computationally bounded adversary, an adversary that can't compute more than 2 to the 112, which is good enough, okay? And then there's something called a block cipher. And so anywhere you use a stream cipher, you can use a block cipher. Anywhere you use a block cipher, you can use a stream cipher. Stream ciphers are used more in like low latency environments. Block ciphers tend to be used where you care more about bandwidth than you care about latency. Stream ciphers are fast in hardware. They're not very efficient in software. Block ciphers tend to be more efficient in software than stream ciphers. Basically, there's enough kind of practical differences that both of them are sort of lingering, okay? So you'll see both stream ciphers and block ciphers in real life. And there's no reason that one is strictly better than the other, okay? There's sort of two different approaches to tackling largely the same problem, okay? So I'll show you both of them. But if you took the sum total of everything, well, now that we have cell phones that are very powerful, I would say that block ciphers are used probably most of the time. Stream ciphers might be used more in the background, like the actual cellular signal from your phone to the satellite might use a stream cipher. Whereas anything on the web that's software-based where you have servers running and that type of thing, it's going to use block ciphers in general. Okay, if you encrypt your hard drive, you're going to use a block cipher. So those are a few ideas of the differences between them. Okay, the final thing I'll say is we're going to punt on the issue of how did Alice and Bob get the same key, okay? If Alice and Bob have never met each other, how do they end up with this shared secret value that only they know and Eve doesn't know them, right? If me and Google want to, you know, send some information, I've never met Google, right? I'm not there. Like, how do I get a secure key, you know, agreed upon with Google? And I can't do it over this channel, right? If I do it over this channel, if I'm like, hey, let's use this key, well, then Eve will see my message saying, let's use this key, then she knows the key as well, okay? So how you do that over a public channel, it turns out there is a way, okay? It's very clever, and it, you know, won the people who invented it, like Turing Awards and things like that. So it's a very sophisticated kind of technique. We'll see it later in the course. It's called key. Diffie-Hellman was the first one that settled that problem, okay? And even it has another, like, kind of core problem underneath it where you still have to know something about each other. But anyways, so we're going to punt on that issue for now, okay? So we're just going to assume that somehow they met in a back alley, whatever. They both have the same key. Eve doesn't. If we have this very generous assumption, can we do secure encryption? Can we do secure message integrity? The answer is yes. Then we'll tackle that problem after. So we'll see this later in terms of the course. Now, all encryption functions, whether they're one-time pad, stream cipher, block cipher, they all have the two same basic functions, okay? They all look kind of the same, okay? They all have an encryption function, which we'll denote as encrypt, okay? Encrypt will take two inputs this time. One of them is going to be the message that we want to encrypt, and the other is going to be this key value that only Alice and Bob know, okay? And it's going to give us an encryption of that message or a sort of secret version of that message. We call it the ciphertext, so we denote it C, okay? So this is the ciphertext, this is the key, this is the message. Okay. The key is going to be fixed length. Okay. And as we'll see, we'll build up to it, but it's going to just have to resist exhaustive search, so it's going to have to be at least 112 bits long. Okay. The message can be any length. So you can encrypt a short message, you can encrypt the contents of your hard drive. Whatever you want to encrypt, it's fine. And the ciphertext will always be the same length as the message. It might be a little bit longer for reasons that we'll talk about, like a little bit, like 128 bits longer or something like that. But effectively, you can think of it as the same length as the message itself, okay? So it's definitely not going to compress the message in any sense. So if you want to encrypt your hard drive and then write back the ciphertext, it's going to take as much space as the original message did itself, okay? So this will also be infinite length, but we'll have this restriction that the length of C will equal the length of the message. Okay, and the final thing is, just like everything we've seen in the course so far, this is a deterministic function. There's no secret randomness buried in it anywhere. If you come along with the same key and the same message, and you run the encryption function, you always get the same answer any day of the week, any of our computers in the room will all generate the exact same C on the exact same two inputs. And it's open in terms of specification, so there's nothing secret or proprietary about it. Okay, it's not like the war times, like the Enigma machine or something like that, where we don't know how it works inside. This is, you can read the spec, you can write it yourself. So the only secret is the key itself. Okay. Now, the other thing we want to do, unlike hashing, so this is the difference between hashing. There's two differences. One difference is we have this key lying around now. Okay, so not just anyone can compute this function. You need the key. But the other thing, unlike a hash, is once you hash it, you can't get the message back. Okay, you can always pepper it with guesses as to what the message would be, and if it comes out to the same value, then you know you found the input, but you can't actually go backwards. With an encryption function, we want to go backwards, okay? So when Alice sends this message to Bob encrypted, Bob wants to take the encryption off and get the message back, okay? When I encrypt the contents of my hard drive, when I want to read that file or open it up, I want to decrypt it, okay? So we need a decryption function as well. So a decryption function will take the same key, K, that's why it's symmetric key, and it's basically just going to be the opposite of the encryption. It's going to take the ciphertext, and it's going to return you the message. Okay, and everything else is the same. The message, the ciphertext, it's all the same size. The key's the same size. Decryption and encryption are both deterministic, open specification, all of that. And this is the same key as encryption. And it's a secret, I should emphasize. Okay, and technically the message here is a secret too. If the message wasn't a secret, you wouldn't bother encrypting it. You would just send it across the wire, okay? So you sort of have, both of these inputs are sort of the secret. The difference is this is a secret that Bob knows as well. If you're Alice sending this, this is a shared secret, whereas your message is... Like, Bob will learn it when he decrypts, but he doesn't know it ahead of time. If he knew it ahead of time, then, once again, there's no reason to actually send it. Okay, questions about encryption, just sort of what they look like at the high level? Okay, so now the question is going to be, how do we actually do it? Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So that's all I meant by it, is that from the ciphertext, you shouldn't be able to recover the message itself. Yeah. So it's going to keep the message as a secret. Other questions? Okay, let's take a 10-minute break, and then I'll show you the first encryption scheme. So come back at 5 after. Okay, so the first encryption scheme we're going to talk about is called a one-time pad. I'll tell you where the name comes from when I show it to you. One-time pad is not used in practice. We'll see why. And the nice thing about it is theoretically theoretically secure. So I'll call it a theoretical construction. I mean, it's not practical, but it's a nice stepping stone to seeing what a stream cipher is. We just do one swap, and then it turns into a stream cipher. You will see like companies like that advertise one-time pads every now and then come along, and it's always like some fake snake oil company. So never invest in something that's promising to do one-time pads. It is perfectly secure. What does perfect mean? It means that breaking it is not just infeasible, it's actually impossible. Okay, and feasible means you can break it. You can write down an algorithm to break it. It's just going to take you the lifetime of the universe to run it, or longer. Impossible means that you can't even write down an algorithm that's going to break it. Okay? What's the drawback? The drawback is that the key size is the same as the message. Okay, so if you want to encrypt an 8-gig hard drive, you're going to need 8-gig key. Okay, and remember, this is a symmetric key setting. So Alice has a key and Bob has a key. So somehow you have to get this 8-gig keys between Alice and Bob. Okay, now this isn't, I shouldn't say it's completely impractical. Sometimes, like during wars and things like that, they would use it and they would actually have like a book of randomness. So it would be like a book and you'd open it up and there'd be a bunch of randomness. And so they call this like a pad. So this is why it's called the one-time pad. Now, you're going to get punished very, very severely if you ever use the same randomness twice. So if you accidentally screw up and lose your place in the pad, you're supposed to use the randomness and then throw it away. And if you accidentally reuse it, then there's an attack that would recover it. And there's examples of this style of encryption used in wars and actual people recovering things because they knew that they had reused part of the key. Okay, so that's sort of just a hint at where one-time pad comes from. You have this like pad of randomness, and you can only use it once. Okay, the algorithm itself is very, very simple. Which is nice. So for encryption, what we're going to do is we're actually going to operate bit by bit, okay? So we're going to take the first bit of our key, and we're going to take the first bit of our message, and it's going to give us the first bit of our ciphertext. Okay, and then we'll do this for, let me write I, it's a little more generic. Okay, and all we do is we take our key. Okay, and we're going to assume that this is a truly random key, okay? And we're going to XOR it with the message, and that's it. Okay, what's an XOR? So we all remember, XOR means if you have two bits, say 0 and 1, and you have another bit, 0 and 1. If you have 0 and 0, it gives you 0. If you have 0 and 1, it gives you 1. If you have 1 and 0, it gives you 1. And if you have 1 and 1, it gives you 0. Okay. It's also the same as A plus B mod 2. If you like modular arithmetic. If you don't like modular arithmetic, you'll come to like it by the end of this course. We'll be doing a lot of it in the second half. So this is the XOR operation. How do we decrypt? It's very easy. We actually do the exact same operation. So we take KI and we XOR CI. And that will return us to the original message. Do you believe me? Let's do an example. So let's say our message is whatever, 1111111. And we have some key. Try and make it look random. Okay. All right, so what's our ciphertext going to be? So it's going to be 1001110. And the promise is if we take this and we XOR it with the key again, we're going to get our original message back. And you can see that that's exactly the case. Okay, and so that's actually true of XORs in general. If you XOR something by the same thing twice, you get back the original thing. Okay, it's like the identity function. Okay, now my proposition to you is that this is perfectly secure. So we didn't really talk about what security means, so let's try and define it. So if Eve does an OK and she sees C, what we're going to say is it's impossible for her to learn anything about M, anything at all. Okay. Now, this actually isn't true. So there is one thing that Eve can learn. Okay. She's not going to learn all of M in its entirety. Okay. And even if she learned one bit of M, we would consider that a breach. But what does she know about M?
The length.
Okay. Because the length of C will be the same as the length of the message, okay? Okay, and so this is going to be true of all encryption, okay? Encryption is never length hiding, okay? So you can always see the length of stuff, okay? And it turns out that this is, I'll just go on a bit of an aside, and if you take 6150 with me, you'll see this in practice, more practical terms, but leaking the length of the message is actually pretty damaging. So imagine, go back to that example where, I don't know, let's say you're going to Wikipedia and Wikipedia is encrypted. So technically the university, even though all your traffic is flowing through the university, they don't know which article on Wikipedia you're looking at, right? But if encryption leaks the length of the message, well, they know that the article that you're looking at is exactly this length long, right? And they know that you're downloading 5 images that are going to populate this article, and each image has this exact size. You know, one is this number of bytes, and the next one's this number of bytes, and this is this number of bytes, okay? So how many Wikipedia articles are exactly that long with exactly 5 images, and each of the images are exactly this size? There's probably only one, right? They probably know exactly what article you're looking at. And then there's all sorts of other little things that you could do to leak that information, okay? So it is possible, just using length alone, to sort of make fingerprints of what certain traffic patterns look like, okay? And so that's just totally out of the scope of encryption, okay? So that is one limitation that we have for encryption. So you should keep that in mind when you start deploying real systems. Okay, now note I used the word impossible, okay? So we're not talking about infeasible anymore. We're actually talking about impossible. And when I mean anything, barring the length of M, that is something, okay, it's something substantial. It means if you can know that the fifth bit of the message is 60% probability it's 1 and 40% probability it's 0, that's something, okay? You learn something about that bit. You still don't know what that bit is, right? But you know something other than it's equally likely 0 or 1. Okay, that's the definition of knowing nothing about that bit. Okay, so we won't allow even that. Okay, so it should be the case that it's truly random. Okay. All right. So how can we say that you actually know nothing about a particular bit? Well, let's think about what you actually know. Okay. So let's say that you start off with CI. Okay, so let's study this bit. The other thing about a stream cipher I'll note is that notice that if I'm computing the second bit of the ciphertext, it only depends on the second bit of the message, right? Okay, so it doesn't matter what these message bits are. They could be anything. They could change. This bit won't change. Okay, so when I'm looking and I see, hey, the second bit of the ciphertext is zero, the only thing that influenced whether that was a zero or one are these two bits, right? The message bit and the key bit at that particular position. No other bits in the key, no other bits in the message had any influence on whether this ended up being a zero or one, okay? So let's stare at C1, okay? So if we stare at the C1 where, or sorry, CI where it's anything, let's consider it the fifth bit, okay? We're looking at the fifth bit, and the fifth bit is either a zero or it's a one. And if it's a zero, what happened? What's a possible scenario where this bit could end up being zero? Okay. All right. So if the message bit's zero and the key bit was zero, we could end up with a zero here. Or if the message bit was one and the key bit was one, we could end up with a zero. Any other combinations not going to give us a zero here. Those are the only two cases. Okay. So it was either the case that MI equaled zero or... and CI equaled zero, okay, as a combination. Or it was the case that they were both one. Thank you. Okay, and then similarly here, they would have to be different bits. So it was either zero and one or one and zero. Okay. What's the probability that KI is zero? We'll start here. So we said we want true randomness, okay, for K. Okay, so it's going to be a half, right? So the probability that we're here is a half. The probability that it's one is also a half. Probability that this is a half is a half. This is a half. Okay. What's the probability that the message bit at I is zero? Okay, so let's say it's a half. Let's accept that as a correct answer. What does that mean about our message?
Random.
It's random, okay. So that's great. So we could encrypt random strings. Do we always encrypt random strings? Okay, so what if I say, like if I'm saying, hello, hi, how are you, right? The fifth bit of that message, hi, how random is it? Okay, so it's sort of random. I could have said hello, hi, hey, you know, there is some randomness there, okay? But it's not perfectly random, okay? The point is that we don't know, I can't tell you how random a particular message bit is, okay? But what I can tell you is that in a good encryption scheme, it doesn't matter how random your message is. An encryption scheme should work with random messages or non-random messages, okay? So we don't want to depend on the message itself to be random in order for the encryption scheme to work, okay? The key is going to be random, and that's good enough, okay? So the message could be completely deterministic, or it could be, completely random or anything in between, okay? So just to sort of note that property to sort of take care of it, let's say that at this particular bit, there's some probability, and it doesn't matter, we'll call it alpha, okay? And we want these alphas to all sort of drop out in the context of our security proof, okay? Then what's the probability that it's that the message bit at that same position is one? If the probability of it is of it being zero is alpha, what's the probability that it's one? Okay, one minus alpha, okay? And so then similarly, this would be alpha, and this would be one minus alpha. So what's the probability? Well, we just multiply them, and that will give us the probability for each of these. So this is alpha over 2 means we end up here. 1 minus, 1, sorry, 1 half minus alpha over 2. So we end up here. This would be alpha over 2. This would be 1 half minus alpha over 2. Okay. Thinking about the best way to denote this. Okay, we'll just follow the notes from last year. Okay, so let's put these two probabilities together, okay? So if CI equals zero, it either happened because of this combination or it happened because of this combination, okay? What's the probability that it happened? It's going to be the sum of these two, okay? So we're going to have a half minus alpha over 2 plus alpha over 2, and so that's going to give us a half, okay? And similarly, down here, we're going to get a half. Okay, so what does this mean? So what this means is the probability that CI equals zero is a half, okay, which is fine, and it didn't depend on alpha, okay? It had nothing to do with alpha at all, okay? It's just a half, okay? If CI equals one, the probability is a half. It has nothing to do with alpha. It has nothing to do with the message itself. What's another object where it will give you zero with probability 1/2 and one with probability 1/2? A coin, okay? So this, basically seeing CI is exactly the same as seeing a flip of a coin. It's going to be zero half the time, and it's going to be 1/2 of the time, okay? Okay, and if I flip a coin 20 times, what does that tell you about a message? It doesn't tell you anything because it has nothing to do with the message, right? There's no message there, okay? So similarly, if I write down 20 CI values, even though I computed it using a message, right, it's not going to tell you anything more than a message than if I just flipped a coin and wrote down that particular coin value as well, okay? So this is perfectly secure. And in general, this XOR function, you can think of it as if you have something that's truly random and you XOR it with something that's not truly random that has some structure, the output will be truly random. Okay? So randomness is sort of, it sort of subsumes. When you mix randomness with non-randomness, you end up with randomness. So the randomness doesn't go away. Okay? That's sort of what happens. That's sort of how randomness behaves. Okay? All right, so I'll just note this is perfectly secure.
If the probability
changed,
then it would not be
secure. If the probability changed, yes. So if these weren't exactly 1/2, okay, what would happen? So let's say that this was like 60%, 40%, okay? Then what would happen is basically, yeah, these wouldn't add up to a half, is essentially what would happen. So the probability that ki equals zero would be, let's say it was 1/3, and this was 2/3 down here. Then the alpha over 2s wouldn't cancel out. They would stay in the equation. And then you would have something that depends on alpha, and that's telling you that it's leaking information about the probability of the message distribution. Yeah. Okay. Okay, let's denote. Now, there's other ways of deriving the perfect security. You can look at the entropy of C, and you would get the same result. So you would look at the probability distribution. So what's the entropy of CI? Well, it happens either with, you know, PI log PI of this plus PI log PI of this, or this and this, and you'll see that the entropy is the same regardless of whether it's CI or C1. You can also do like a Bayesian analysis, so there's different ways of coming to the same conclusion. This I just found is the more intuitive way of explaining it. Okay. So let's consider some practical drawbacks. So if we want to use this in real life, what are some drawbacks? And then we'll solve some of them, and some of them we'll just sort of not solve. Okay, so the big problem is K is large, and both parties need it. So it'd be much better to do this with some smaller value of K, if we can help it. K needs to be truly random. Okay, one thing I hinted at before I didn't show you yet is you cannot reuse bits of K. I'll show you why. So let's say that we have some message MI and we XOR it with KI, okay? And then we come along with some other message bit and we XOR it with the same KI, okay? So this will give us one ciphertext and this will give us a slightly different one. So remember, the adversary sees CI and CI prime, okay? They don't know KI and they don't know MI prime, okay? And ideally, they shouldn't learn anything about MI prime, okay? What could they do in this scenario? How could they learn something about? So they're not going to learn both of these bits, okay? But they're going to learn something that's useful.
Matches between two the same letter, they can skip the ciphers to the same one, they would know at least two.
Okay. So if both of these end up being the same value, right, then when you XOR them with the same value, you're going to end up with the same value, okay? So as soon as you look at these two things, if they're the same, then these two were the same, and if they're different, then these two were different, okay? I'll put it a little more formally. What you can do is you can take CI and XOR it with CI prime, okay? And that's going to give you MI XORed with MI prime. Technically XORed with KI, XORed with KI, but if you XOR something by the same value twice, it cancels out, okay? That's the other property of XORs. Let me just get it all on one line. Okay, these two cancel. So you're not learning what MI and MI prime are, but you are learning the XOR of them, and that's useful information. Specifically, an XOR will tell you whether they were the same, if the XOR was zero, or if they were different. Okay, so that's exactly what it means. Okay, the fourth is something that we've seen before. It's this problem of malleability. We're going to keep coming back to it. Okay. So let's say Eve sees this ciphertext go across the wire, and she has no idea what encrypts. You know, it's your salary or something like that. She doesn't know what that actual number is. Now, let's say she takes a bit of C and flips it. Let's say she flips the fifth bit of C as it goes across the wire. Okay, Bob doesn't know that Eve was there and flipping bits in the middle, so Bob just takes that and that C, this new C, and runs it through his decryption function. He gets out a message. The message is going to be different than the original message. How is it going to be different? Okay, so first off, remember that if you, for any bit of the ciphertext, it only results in a change in one bit of the message, remember? Like every bit of ciphertext only depends on these two values and vice versa, Okay, so it's not flipping a bit here cannot, it's not going to flip any bits over here, okay? At most, it's going to change this value, okay? But more specifically, then it might change. What can we say specifically? So let's say we want to flip this from a 0 to a 1. What happens here?
Zero.
It flips, okay? And that's the same. If we flip this, this one flips. Okay, so it's exactly that relationship. So it's not just that we're going in and we're changing things and we don't know what's happening. It's that we actually know exactly what's happening. So if I see a message, encrypted message, go by, and for some reason I want to flip the fifth bit of that message, I know how to do that. I flip the fifth bit of the ciphertext, and then when Bob decrypts, that fifth bit of the message will be flipped. Okay, so we call this malleability. So it's like the length extension attack. It's like where you have something that you don't know, some message, you don't know what it is, but you're manipulating it in some way that you know. Okay, so with length extension, you had this message, you didn't know what it was, but you were adding some things onto the end, and you knew what you were doing. Similarly here, you don't know what the message is itself, but you can structurally change it, okay, in ways that are predictable, okay? And we'll see this over and over again, okay? Almost all primitives that we talk about have some malleability problem, and then we always try and get rid of those malleability problems, okay? Okay, so if E flips CI, then when Bob decrypts, MI will be flipped in the exact same location. Okay, if you want to flip these 5 bits but leave these other 5 bits alone, then that's fine. You flip those 5 bits of the ciphertext. Yeah.
You said
Right. So this was a question that we sort of touched on. So what will change here is that this probably will change from a half. So this, for the rest of the room, like, it doesn't really matter. Don't get hung up on this point, but I'll just try and explain it. So this could be, say it's a third, okay? Then this would have to be 2/3 as well, okay? Now you're going to have alpha over 3, but then you're going to have 2 alpha over 3. And so the alphas aren't going to cancel when you subtract them. And so you're going to have some probability here that depends on alpha. And so what that's telling you is that when you see whether CI is either 0 or 1, it's going to tell you something about the message bit itself. Yeah. Okay. Okay. And then the fifth point is that it leaks the length of the message. Okay. So what we want to do is we want to try and solve some of these problems. Of these problems we solve, what we're going to do is we're going to solve these two problems, okay, 1 and 2, and we're going to do it with something called a stream cipher, and stream ciphers will still be vulnerable to 3, 4, and 5, okay? So you're still not going to be able to reuse bits of K, okay? And how do we do that? Well, we just take care of it in software. We're really careful. And if we're unsure of where we left off, we just generate a new K value and start over again. Okay? How do we deal with malleability? We're not going to design a non-malleable encryption scheme. What we're going to do is we're going to invent some other encryption scheme. It's not going to be called encryption. It's going to be called Max. And it's going to do this sort of like malleability protection for us, okay? And then we're going to combine it. So basically, we're going to try and solve this problem outside of the problem of encryption. We're going to combine encryption with some sort of error correction that's going to avoid this particular problem, okay? How do we solve this problem? We don't. This is still a problem today. It's a problem on the web. It's a problem with any kind of encryption, stream cipher, block cipher, okay? So no one solves the problem of 5, okay? All right, so let's go back to the one-time pad. We'll write down one-time pad first. Okay, so in the one-time pad, I'll just write the encryption. CI equals MI XORed KI. Okay, and in fact, let's not write it in the bit case. Let's just assume that we have the full length of everything. So I'll just say this is a bitwise XOR. So think of this as like 128 bits, and this is 128 bits, and this is 128 bits, or this is 4 gigs, this is 4 gigs, and this is 4 gigs. Doesn't matter. Okay, now what's our problem? Our big problem is we don't like K. Okay, too big, too random. So how do we make K smaller? Okay, well, let's just literally make it smaller. So if we make it 128 bits and this is 4 gigs, well, first off, this operation doesn't make sense, right? You can encrypt the first 128 bits, and then what are you going to encrypt it with? If you loop this, like say you do 128 bits and then loop it in 128 bits, so you sort of repeat the same 128 bits, then you're reusing the key, okay? So that's problem number 3. So we can't do that, okay? So if we want to use a key that's shorter than M, we have to take that short key and we got to make it big somehow, but we can't reuse it. We can't just use that same value over and over and over again, okay? So how could we take a short thing and make it big in a way that the big thing looks like something that's random? Okay, so a PRG is exactly what we need. Okay, it's a perfect solution to this particular problem. Okay, and that's all a stream cipher is. Okay, a stream cipher is okay. We take K, we run it through a PRG, such that the output is the same size of M. And then we XOR the two together, okay? So it looks exactly the same as our one-time pad. Where is it? Here. Except for this is pseudo-random instead of truly random, okay? And if we want Bob to generate, so note here, both of them have to have the same value here in order for one to encrypt and one to decrypt, okay? But if it's pseudo-random, then they don't have to have that whole stream, okay? They just need to have the seed. They both have the same seeds. Starting from the same seed, they can generate the same stream because PRG is deterministic, okay? So that's the idea here, okay? So this is going to be a 112-bit or greater than 112-bit, at least 112-bit. The output of this will be whatever the length of your message is. Okay. So it can be as long as you want it to be. This thing will be, well, whatever length it is, and the ciphertext will end up being the same length as the message as well. Okay, and then if we want to decrypt, what do we do? So we're going to take our ciphertext, we're going to XOR it, and what Bob's going to do is the exact same thing that Alice did. He's going to start with the key as a seed, he's going to compute PRG on it, so that will give him a stream, and then he's going to XOR it with C, and he'll get back M. And, yes, thank you. And I'll just note that this is a bitwise XOR. Okay, I'm not going to do a formal security definition for this. We'll see those with block ciphers, but I'll just note. So let's just look at the encryption function itself. So this is, remember, what the adversary sees. So the adversary sees this C value. The adversary doesn't know M or K. So they see those values, and she doesn't know these two values. Okay, so PRG says that this is indistinguishable from random. So what does that mean? Well, if we go back to our little chart here, it means that is KI equals 0 exactly a half? And is KI equals 1 exactly a half? No, it's not exactly 1 half, but your computer can't tell it apart. It's so close to a half that there's no way your computer is going to know the difference between it actually being a half. So for all effective purposes, it's a half, and then the computation ends up being exactly the same. It's like a coin toss when you see this value of C. So indistinguishable from random really means it's indistinguishable from a one-time pad. So it's not a one-time pad, but you can't tell the difference, okay, because this PRG, okay? The other thing you could think about is, let's say you actually know the message M, okay? Like say it's, I don't know, let's say it's like some web traffic and you know that at least the first part of a web packet always looks the same, right? It always has some structure at the start of it that denotes what protocol it's using and what version number and things like that, okay? So what you could do is, as an adversary, it might not be the case that you actually don't know anything about M, okay? You might know something about M. Or maybe you know M is one of two messages. Like, say it's like an election and this is either an encryption of Alice or an encryption of Bob, depending on who's being voted for, okay? So you know whether it's Alice or whether it's Bob, okay? Now, what you could do is, let's say that you know that this person happens to be voting for Alice, okay? You just know they're an Alice supporter, whatever, okay? So what you can do is, if you pencil this in, you know this C value, and if you know that M is Alice, then you can learn what this value is, okay? This value is just going to be the XOR of C and M, okay? You can move the M over to the other side, okay? So now you know what this value is here, okay? Now, let's say that Alice then goes and encrypts something else, and she uses the same PRG K, okay? So she generates a bunch of bits to encrypt her vote for Alice, then she generates a bunch of bits, and now she's encrypting whatever else, okay? Can you figure out what that second message is because you know what the first message is, okay? If you know what the first message is, you do know what the output of this is, okay? But in order to decrypt the second message, you would have to know, based on this output of the PRG, you'd have to know the next bits that are coming, okay? And we said that with a PRG, if you see some output of a PRG, you can't predict what the next bits are, okay? So even if you know what one particular message is and you can figure out what the output of PRG is, there's no way you can predict the next bits. Therefore, you can't break future encryption, okay? So every message that you send is independently encrypted. Another way you could think about it is, if you see PRG of K, do you know what K is? Because if you know what K is, then you know the key. Then you can decrypt anything with that key. Okay? You don't, because remember, PRG hides K. It's a one-way function. Okay? So seeing the output of PRG K doesn't tell you what K is either. Okay? So we're really relying on the security of PRG. So if our PRG is broken, the stream cipher is broken. Okay? We need the PRG to be secure in order for the stream cipher to be secure. So let's try and write some of this down. Okay. So if I encrypt 5 messages, you know what the first message is. You don't know what the next 4 are. Just because you see the encryption of the first message and you know what it is and you can compute what PRDK is for that first message, it's not going to help you break the other 4 messages. Okay, that's basically the lesson. Yeah. So when I say the next bit's a PRGK, I am assuming that you're using the next bit. So remember, PRG is something where you draw a couple bits and then you draw a couple more bytes and a couple more bytes from it. I'm not sure exactly where you're stuck. So PRG, it has an infinite size output. You don't tend to generate that whole output. You sort of generate the first chunk of bits you need, then the next chunk. Yeah, okay. So if you're encrypting messages, you can use the same PRGK. You just grab the first chunk of bits for the first message, then you grab the next chunk the next time and keep going. Other questions? Okay, so let me show you what one of these looks like. So I'll show you Cha-Cha-20. Okay, so this is from a cryptographer named Dan Bernstein, and Cha-Cha-20 is like, I struggled to find a stream cipher that, because everyone used RC4. RC4 was used all over the place, and then it got broken, and no one decided what to replace RC4 with. There was a competition that was held to replace it. It wasn't held by NIST, though. It was held by this European group, and they made kind of a mistake, in my opinion, where they didn't choose one stream cipher. What they did is they chose like 5, and they said, you can use any of these 5. And so as a result, no one knew which one to use. It's a lot easier when you just say, here's one, use it. They were trying to say, well, some are good in software, some are good in hardware, et cetera, et cetera. So you have more flexibility. But yeah, paradox of choice, no one knew which of the 5 to use. And so I forget if it was exactly 5, but it was like a suite. And so there hasn't been a sole replacement for RC4. So of all the stream ciphers out there, I picked Cha-Cha-20 because Google's pushing it. And Google, I use Google a lot as an example. The reason I use it is probably the biggest application for cryptography is on the web. Okay, so when you go to a website like Google or even the course website, you can see that there's this little lock that appears. When you click on it, you also see it's HTTPS as opposed to HTTP. That means crypto was used between me and Concordia, okay? Exactly what crypto is being used, we'll talk about, okay? That'll be the last lecture of the class. I'll show you what that crypto looks like, okay? Now what's special about Google? Well, if you want to change the crypto that's used, you need Concordia to change their crypto because they have a computer, a server somewhere that's supporting this, okay? And then you also have to change my computer because my computer has to talk. So basically, Concordia's server and my computer have to talk the same language. So if you want to make any change, you need to change both endpoints, okay? And there's very few parties that control both of those endpoints, okay? Your operating system is one, so like Apple, Microsoft, and your browser is the other one, okay? So Mozilla or Google. There are people who can change client-side, and then servers can change whatever. They can run whatever they want, okay? Now, Google's a nice example because they have a reasonably popular browser, Chrome. Okay, lots of people use it. And when you look at mobile, Android, right, all Androids using Chrome. And they have a very popular website, right, the number one website on the web, okay? So when you have the most popular website and you have a very popular browser, then you can play around with settings. And maybe they only work between your browser and your site and no one else supports it. But the rest of the industry, they pay attention to what you're doing. And if you can show that some crazy protocol works a little more efficiently or whatever the case may be, then other people will start supporting it as well. Okay, so Google can like really kind of push things through. So Google decided for whatever reason that Cha-Cha-20 was the stream cipher they're going to use. Okay, so if you go to Google from Chrome, you'll see that Cha-Cha-20 is the stream cipher that is used in that context. And since then, other websites have started to support it. I don't know that any other browser supports it. It might be the case that Safari supports it, or IE, or Firefox. I'm not sure. But anyways, that's why I picked this one as the sort of illustrative stream cipher. Okay. So this is for any Google service, Gmail or Google search or whatever. The other thing about it is, so there's more to an encryption function in HTTPS connection than just the encryption function itself. Okay, there's another big piece of it. So in both cases, they both use Dan Bernstein designs. And what's important about this from Google's sort of a political perspective is that actually NIST didn't choose CHA-CHA-20. Okay, NIST chose like all the other ciphers, and we went through this sort of experience where there was another standard that was actually on PRGs. So NIST had some standard PRGs, and they had one PRG where there was a secret that was built into it called a backdoor, and anyone who knows that value of the secret could distinguish its output from random. Okay. It didn't have the correct properties of a PRG. And anyways, I'm not going to bore you with the details. You can do it as a class project if you want to look at it. I think it's on the class list. It's called Dual EC. And long story short, it looked like the NSA, which is the spy agency in the US, had tried to sort of get NIST, whether NIST knew it or not, they sort of influenced NIST in order to get this standardized. And so there was a lot of, we went through this period where no one trusted anything that NIST did. Because they thought everything was backdoored, including Google, who didn't trust them enough to say, "Well, let's do at least one way of doing HTTPS where we don't use any NIST stuff in order to do it." So we're going to look at other people. So who are some other people that are doing NIST kind of things, but they aren't actually NIST? So Dan Bernstein is one of them, sort of the predominant one who's doing it today. He does like really fast, like crypto primitives, lots of optimizations and things like that. Okay. So anyway, that's sort of the backstory of CHA-CHA-20. What does it look like? So I'm just going to show you the slide as opposed to actually write it out. So you're not going to be tested on any of this. The reason I'm showing this to you is just so that, like the same reason I showed you the compression function, just so you believe it's not magic. Okay, it is something you can write it down. It's not like that complicated. There's a lot of design to it, but anyways. Okay. All right, so what's going to happen is you're going to start with your seed, okay? And your seed is going to be represented into 8 chunks, and I forget what the size is. So we're going to have a 256-bit seed, and we're going to break them into 32 bits each, okay? And it's best to think of it sort of graphically. So you can imagine the seed is kind of in this value here, okay? Now, with the stream cipher, we haven't talked about it, but what you're going to do is you're going to add some randomness to it yourself. So if you encrypt the same message twice with the same seed or the same key, it's going to give you completely different ciphertext. Okay, so we're going to revisit this later when we talk about block ciphers. But anyway, this is called the IV. You can see that the IV is down here as well. And then these are constants that Dan Bernstein chose. Okay, and he has written down his reasons why he chose them for you. Okay. So you can think of this as sort of the internal state. So when you start off with your encryption function, or in this case, just the PRG itself, you start in this particular state. Okay, so these middle values are the seed that you chose. This is some randomness that you chose, and this is some fixed value thing. Okay, then what you're going to do is you're going to do some operation where you're going to do each column of this state. You're going to do some function on these four cells. You're going to do some function on these four cells, these four cells, these four cells. Then you're going to do sort of diagonally, okay? So you're going to kind of mix it up. So you're going to do some function on these four cells and rewrite them. And then these cells in the purple one down here, rewrite them, et cetera, okay? And then you're going to repeat this 20 times, okay? So it's like a blender where you're, you know, you're doing these simple operations, but you're doing them over and over and over again, okay? So what are the operations that take four chunks and output four chunks? Well, the first one So all four of them are defined basically as this. So if your four chunks come in as A, B, C, D, what you're going to do is you're just going to start messing around with them. So you're going to, some of them will get added together. Some of them will get XOR together. Some of them will get bit shifted. And you'll go through this particular operation. Okay? And then at the end of the day, you're going to have new values of A, B, C, D. You'll write them back to the particular state, and then you'll just repeat it again, okay? So anyways, that, I know that's like a high-level summary that doesn't leave you very convinced, but the main takeaway from this is kind of like the compression function. Okay, it's not magic. The operations are very simple. They're very fast, okay? They're simple ORs and XORs, but you're doing a lot of things, and you're doing it a lot of times. You're sort of repeating it, okay? So this step here, we tend to call it confusion. The reason we call it confusion is that when you look at the output, it's hard to figure out what the input was that gave you that particular output. So it's kind of hard to go backwards, okay? And then when we scramble things up, okay? So when we say, well, this, what's sitting here is going to impact what's sitting here, okay? And what's sitting here is going to, like, what's sitting here is going to impact all four of these cells in this round, but then it's going to impact all four of these cells. Okay, and then in the next round, because it's sitting on the diagonal, it's going to affect all four, right? So we call that diffusion. So the little changes that you're making sort of spread throughout the system. And anyway, it gets like really hard to write down, you know, like an equation that would reverse this whole process. Okay. So anyway, that's sort of the key ideas behind. Analyzing this. If you want to look at it in more detail, once again, it's very suitable class project. Cryptanalysis is the topic of studying this, trying to reverse it. There are little tricks that you can do. There's things called differential cryptanalysis, linear cryptanalysis, where you can try and write down some equations that are going to give you some information about undoing these things. And the other thing that people do is they study reduced round versions of this. Okay, so maybe after 20 rounds, you get totally confused and you don't know what any of the inputs were, but maybe after one round, you could figure it out, okay? And whatever techniques you use to solve one round, well, maybe someone else can extend them a bit to two rounds or three rounds and four rounds, okay? And that's how these things tend to get broken, is over time, they start with lower rounds and then we go to more and more rounds. Okay, questions about this? The IV also, I'll note this as well. There is a counter value. So the first time you encrypt, you set it to 1, and then you set it to 2, and you set it to 3. And this is what stops you from reusing the same key stream more than once, okay? So every time you go in, you increment this counter, and then you recompute the state. So you do the same task, basic task, a lot of times. It's simple, logic based. So it's going to be fast. Hardware, software, hardware in particular, it's faster. And software operating a bit at a time isn't always the most efficient. So we can introduce this idea of confusion diffusion. So the logic operations will add confusion, and then you want to spread around. We'll spread the confusion around, okay? And so the main trick is that if you start off with the exact same state, so you start with your your state, and I start with my state, and it's exactly the same. We have the same constants, we have the same IV, we have exactly the same seed, except for mine ends with a 0 and your ends with a 1, okay? So initially, the only difference is going to be in one bit of this particular chunk, and this chunk is 32 bits, okay? So one bit of this 32-bit chunk is going to be different than yours, okay? But by the end of this whole process, we should end up with completely different states, okay? So that one bit difference is going to kind of corrupt this whole state. And then on the next round, it's going to corrupt this diagonal. And then that diagonal is going to spread. And then it's just going to keep spreading around and spreading around and spreading around, okay? So after 20 rounds, it will be just completely different. And so sometimes we call that an avalanche effect, where one small difference, usually it's defined as a single bit influence, will completely change the output. So if you have two inputs, they only differ by one bit. The output should be just random in terms of the difference, in terms of how they look. Yeah, yeah.
When there's 32-bit data,
yeah.
We put 8 bits in. So there's the first 8 bits, the only 8 bits, which are the presentation we run. The rest of the message is same.
Yeah, so you mean in terms of my example or in terms of how it works in general? In my example? Yeah, so what I was saying is that this square right here represents 32 bits. And so what I'm saying is imagine your 32 bits and my 32 bits are all the same except for that last bit. Yeah.
Just to confirm, the PRG keeps its randomness because we're XORing, doing logical mathematical equations with a random element. So that's why it stays random.
So yeah, so because the seed starts off as random.
So the random window.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, that's why these constants get obliterated. Yeah. Okay, other questions? These constants are meant to sort of promote better diffusion. That's why they're structured in such a way. Yeah. Okay, questions about this? Okay. And then once you have your PRG, then you just XOR it with your message, and then you have a stream cipher. So there's no stream cipher there. Okay, now the other way of doing encryption is called the block cipher. Okay. All right, so a block cipher and a stream cipher, they look exactly the same. We have some key. It has a certain length that can't be exhaustively searched. So we'll say, so that's denoted at K. K is greater than 112. M can be any size that we want. And I remember now. Okay. What I'm going to do is, I'm going to define block cipher slightly weird. And this will become apparent later. Okay. So let's think of a block cipher actually as taking a certain size input, and it will give you a certain size output. Okay, L. And what we'll say is that, for example, L might be 128 bits. Okay. And then we have our key, and our key can be any size. It could be, say, 112 bits, okay? So how is this different than a stream cipher? Well, first off, we're not taking an infant-sized message, okay? We're taking a block of a message, okay? And the second thing is that every bit of this output ciphertext will depend, or say, let me put it differently. One bit of the output, let's say the first bit of C, will depend on every bit of M, okay? It won't be like a ciphertext where the first bit of C depends only on the first bit of M, okay? So what we'll have is basically, you can think of it as kind of like, this is, say, 128 bits. It goes into an encryption function, and the encryption function will have some key, and it will come out at 128 bits, okay? So this particular bit here, in a stream cipher, it would depend only on, right, this particular bit of the message, okay? But here, this particular bit's going to depend on the entire message itself, okay? And that's true of all the bits in the ciphertext, okay? So we're sort of mixing all the bits around in terms of block cipher, okay? So block cipher, we're operating block by block in terms of encryption, okay? Now, going block by block could be faster, particularly in software. What we saw, though, if you look at Cha-Cha 20, you kind of are generating randomness in these big blocks anyway. So it's really not that like different than a stream cipher. The main difference is this property, which is just that the output here depends on all the input bits here. Okay, why is this important? I'll just sort of tease it. Well, it means that let's say you're Eve and you flip this bit. Okay, if you flip this bit in a stream cipher, it would just flip this bit of the message. If you flip this bit, it's going to destroy this whole block of the message. Okay, the message is going to be garbage, noise, randomness, whatever you want to call it. Okay, so it's going to be a lot harder to do these malleability attacks in block ciphers, but not impossible. Okay, they're actually surprisingly malleable. Okay, and then we're going to need a decryption function, and it's going to look the same, just inverted. Okay, so encryption works on a fixed length message of L bits. It's generally 128 or 256, and it's called a block. That's where the name block cipher comes from. Now, let's say I want to encrypt my hard drive. Well, my hard drive is a lot bigger than 256 bits, okay? So I can't use a block cipher, or at least I can't use it directly, okay? Because it only takes 256, that's it, okay? So what I need to do is I need to figure out how am I going to use this block cipher if I have to encrypt 120, or sorry, if I have to encrypt, say, 4 gigs, okay? So what I might do is I might take the first 128 bits, run it through my encryption function, then I'll take the next 128, run it through, and just repeat that, okay? So what I've actually defined is sort of a chain, a mode. It's kind of like in Merkle Dam Guard, where you had this compression function, it only took a certain size input, and you kind of chained it together, okay? So block ciphers are the same way. You need some strategy for how you're going to operate on big data, data that's bigger than one block long, okay? So you're going to do something like Merkle Dam Guard, okay? And so that thing that you do is called a mode of operation, okay? So we want to encrypt any size data. So this is called the mode of operation. And the simplest mode of operation is actually what I just defined. So you take your first 128 bits, you encrypt it. You take your next 128 bits, you encrypt it. You take your next 128 bits and encrypt it. Okay? It's called, it has a fancy name. It's called ECB, which stands for Electronic Code Book. And so that's the first mode of operation we'll look at. And it's the simplest. Turns out that it's really insecure. There's all sorts of problems with it. And so what we'll do is we'll look at more complicated ways of arranging these mode of operations that are going to give us slightly better properties, okay? But that's going to be next class. So is there any quick questions before we break? Yeah. So yeah, I... forgot that I did block ciphers before Mac, so I'll just drop the Mac component of it. In fact, the whole, like, even the PRG one's kind of stupid. I don't know. I'll update it before 9 p.m. tonight. Okay, I'll probably just drop all of question 2, actually. Yeah. Maybe I'll replace it with something else. You'll see. It'll be a surprise. So come ask me questions until 9 o'clock so I can't replace it with something else. Okay, I'll see you all next week. Or in 2 weeks, I guess. Next week's the holiday.